Welcome to the Media Cat Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Mike Pigger, editor at the magazine. And for today's pod chat, I'd like to welcome Tom Gent, founder and head of creative at award-winning creative content agency, Founder Creative. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, Mike. Nice to see you.
I managed to get myself in a tongue twister with that intro, but it's fine. It's fine.
Founder of Founder Creative is not an easy one. So I'll let you off.
Yeah, I was going to say, my part of my intro, actually, I was going to say you've had a career spanning two decades in the media and entertainment industries, worked for the BBC on a plethora of sports content, produced Top Gear for a year, directed a film for UEFA, and worked as a global creative director for the video games publisher Electronic Arts, or EA. Quite a speed trip through your career there. Does it ever feel strange when someone does that?
Yeah, it does a little bit. You know, been speaking to a few people more recently. It's like, wow, your career, you know, it's great. And I don't think you never really appreciate probably fully how lucky you've been and the stuff that I have worked on. So yeah, I do feel very fortunate to have worked on things that I've enjoyed. So yeah, but no, it is. And also, you know, I'm 42 now, which is absolutely bananas. So yeah, it's gone very quickly. So, but, you know, it's been great. So yeah, really enjoyed it up until this point for sure.
Are there any sort of standout moments or highlights, would you say, career-wise? Or I mean, there's probably lots that we can get into. I just wondered if you ever take that moment to reflect and be like, how did I get here? Or, oh my God, I did that.
Yeah, there's probably a couple along the way. I think there's been, you know, a bit of luck involved along the way as well to sort of make your way through. But I think one thing that was 10 years ago now was the as a sports, you know, working in BBC Sport, which I'm, you know, we'll talk about, but I was fortunate enough to be picked to make the closing montage for the World Cup, which in the department was quite a big, you know, prestigious deal. And I got it for the 2014 World Cup in Brazil. And having made that with Steve Williams, the editor, who's amazing, he's gone on to make McEnroe and a load of other feature films, the Jack Charlton doc and stuff. We made that, and that subsequently sort of was a bit of a springboard, I guess, into kind of having the bravery to then leave the BBC, which, you know, you can definitely, you know, hold on and on and on. But that gave us gave me the springboard to kind of make that leap. So I think looking back, that was a big moment for me, and how well that was received. Yeah, it was a football montage, but we kind of, you know, put a bit of creative into it, and these dancers and shot around Rio and stuff. So I think that was probably. One of the ones that springs to mind for sure.
Yeah, I was going to say, I suppose reflecting, you know, it's been about 5 years since you launched your agency. Did you left EA in Vancouver to do that, right? Was that the stage of your life stage to do that?
That's right. Yeah. Been over in Vancouver for coming up to 3 years at that point, I think it was. And it just felt like we'd had a baby. My wife had, you know, my girlfriend at the time, then my wife, we'd moved out to Canada. And, you know, a few life things had changed, and my wife wanted to move back because she's in the TV industry and various things like that, that we just felt that was the right time. And within EA, it was kind of, you know, it was either stay, get a bigger place, you know, look at potential promotion if that was the case, or make the move back. And we decided at that point to make the move back, which was then the catalyst for going, right, well, if you're going to do it, now is the time to do it. You're kind of fresh back in the country. You'd have to reignite all of your contacts again, or, you know, start sort of fishing around for a new role. That was definitely the determining factor in it all.
I mean, I was kind of looking at your some of the clients that you've worked for, and maybe it wasn't, you know, for a lot of people, maybe launching their own agency is a big risk, but was it a big risk? Because, you know, you worked with EA, McLaren, Mercedes, Supercell. I just wondered, like, when you got going, did it feel like actually this is a natural evolution of what you're doing? And I suppose reflecting, you know, how much has your agency changed in these first 5 years?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because me and my wife often talk about it and how we, you know, I started it up. And it didn't, at the time, and, you know, it's quite good that I was, I guess, a bit naive to it, but it didn't feel like a risk because it felt like if it doesn't work, I'll go back to a 9-to-5, as it were. You know, I'll go back to the day job and work for someone else. So it didn't feel like, I didn't kind of feel as though there was lots of stuff that I had already achieved, and I kind of had a a CV that would mean I was, you know, I could take that leap. I didn't rely on any of that. It was just sort of a this idea that, yeah, if it didn't work, I could go back to something else. And the timing was just as it was, that it meant that it was the chance to go for it. So I think that was, yeah, it was quite good, I think, that I didn't have that fear factor, because, you know, it can be quite scary. I had a kid and we got married and, you know, we'd moved back to the UK and I'd rent to pay and all that stuff. And then we started, the agency actually started the 1st of February, 2020. So 6 weeks before the whole world ended. So, so that was that, you know, we managed to obviously stay afloat, which was great. But I think in the, you know, in terms of learnings and things like that over the last 5 years, I think one of the main things has been to know your value and also value your time. I think that certainly in the early days, I'd say yes to lots and lots of things. And, you know, you might say yes to things that might not in the long run be a great idea, but you feel like you can't say no. And it's been nice, obviously, over time now to grow in confidence and grow in sort of stature, as, you know, we're still obviously a small fish in the big pond sort of thing, but we can now have the confidence to go like, that's probably not for us. And I think that's been a big learning so far, that I didn't have that confidence initially to say no. And over time, valuing my own time, bringing in people to help, and also knowing what you want to work on, what you don't want to work on. Because the whole foundations of the business really is, we don't want to work with 30 brands. We want to work with 10 or 12 cool ones that we love and that hopefully we can have a really good working relationship with. So not spreading yourself too thinly, I think, has been key to us sort of having the success that we've had.
Is there any sort of, when you're doing these types of business decisions or life decisions in your career, what would be the difference between, I don't know, just freelancing, for example, you know, versus the need to, say, start an agency? Or is it just, I mean, I suppose one's a lot more of a robust offering, right? If you're talking to brands, et cetera, versus you freelancing. I don't know if that's possible given the type of work you do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I left the BBC, I actually went freelance at that point. So I kind of, you know, again, that's another place where you don't really want to say no to whatever the next, you know, because you don't know when the next bit of work's coming around the corner. So I think with it, starting something, it's having the sort of autonomy and being your own boss, being able to pick and choose, was something that I was, you know, was a definite benefit. You know, it's kind of, you know, you always kind of end up working mad hours anyway, kind of if you work for someone or work for yourself, I guess, but you can decide, at least you can have some sort of decision making if it's your own thing. So I think there was that, and there was also, you know, one of the main reasons why Founders started up was being sat on the other side of the fence and having major agencies pitch and hearing ideas and thinking, well, I've got two or three ideas as well. And, you know, thinking like that and wanting to back myself and going like, well, what's the worst that can happen? And also, I think I've probably got something to offer here. So, you know, I think in terms of getting in front of the right people, starting your own agency was the way to go, and being sort of in the driving seat rather than doing it for someone else. And also giving myself, selfishly, the lifestyle where I can take my kids to school and I can pick them up and I can do those kinds of things to a certain degree. So they were the benefits, I think. And if you get it right, you know, you can, and it's successful, it can be really incredibly rewarding. And so that's been another thing that I've found over the last few years.
Yeah, and that makes sense. You guys were recognized as an independent agency to watch this year. How was that? Did that just come out of the blue? Has it impacted the business in any way, or was it just a sort of a nice thing?
Yeah, that was lovely. That was fantastic to be recognized. And I think we've not really shouted about ourselves too much. So it's nice to get that recognition and have people get in touch through LinkedIn and drop us an email and things like that. So it has been really, really great. And, you know, there's hopefully a, you know, other moments where we'll sort of be recognized in the future with awards and things like that. Because something, again, that I've learned was, I've always let other people judge whether my or our work is good, rather than shouting from the rooftops about it or saying, this is great, you need to see this. And I think that actually is something quite important, and it's not, winning an award isn't just a vanity thing, which I kind of at one point may have thought that it's really important to moving your business forward and having that recognition and having that visibility. So to be recognized as an agency to watch is fantastic. And yeah, it, when we were there at the sort of a reveal announce ceremony, if you will, there was a few people that spoke there as well. There was a guy called, I think this is right, Michael Heaven, who was social chain, worked with Michael Bartlett, went off, started his own thing. And he is effectively using the business model that we have. And to hear that was, again, really encouraging, because you can live in a, your own world, really, in a, you know, in your own agency, and to go and meet other people and speak to them and hear how they're doing it, even though some of them might almost be rivals in some way, but hearing how they've done it and thinking, wow, he's been really successful, or she's been really successful, and they've got a similar model to us, and you know, those kinds of things. So that's also been, that was great. So as an event itself, it was really, really good. And yeah, as I say, it's been a good few months for us since that got announced and people getting in touch. So long may that continue.
Good stuff. I guess I keep going into sort of reflective mode on your career, but I guess jumping back a little bit, 20 years ago, I was looking that you were early in your career, you're a researcher at MTV, as far as I understand it, researching Pimp My Ride UK. Yeah. How was that? What did that entail? And did you learn anything in that role that you've sort of carried on throughout your career, or was it just an interesting moment?
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, being at MTV in the early noughties was amazing. You know, I'd gone Manchester, Union, Newcastle, and then down to London, and sort of had a, you know, I was a runner on Biker Grove. Then Biker Grove was owned by Zenith North. They got me CD UK and SMTV for a weekend. They asked me back for a summer. I met someone at a barbecue, Dan Baldwin, who was an exec at MTV. He got me an interview at MTV, and it all started from there. So a few fortuitous sort of moments in life there, where I ended up moving down to London and taking what was initially an internship on MTV News, with Tim Cash presenting, and Ollie Wiggins was in charge, with a guy called Alex Bastin. So I've got to learn from some incredible people. I was fresh out of uni, and having that news internship, I think it was earning $9,000 a year, but it was the best. You know, you're just plunged into, it's like, here's a microphone, go and interview Tom Cruise on the red carpet at the Last Samurai premiere sort of stuff, you know. So you got totally thrown into it. And that time in Camden at MTV, you know, it was the Amy Winehouse years, you know, Razor Light, The Strokes, all that kind of explosion of that kind of, you know, music at that time was incredible. So being there was brilliant. Some amazing people who have gone on to do brilliant things. And yeah, you know, Pimp My Ride, an incredible creative. I was kind of a junior there, but I was, you know, if I'd researched the person that we were going to go and have the car made over with and come up with the themes. And it was a real chance to creatively express myself. I love cars, you know, those kinds of things. So it was a really good match to sort of get my initial first real role, I guess, to get my creative juices flowing and just think, yes, I love this. I thought of that, and then there it is on TV. You know, they've painted that car orange because that was my idea, or there's an Xbox in the back and a, you know, surfboard on the roof, and I thought of that. So that kind of gave me, I guess, that initial buzz creatively to maybe think there's something in this, and I can see it. It's there on screen. So that was certainly, I think, the start of my creative journey. And again, it was just the trust placed in me at that time. So working with brilliant people who place trust in junior members of the team, and it's something that I've tried to carry on with the business now, which again has been really successful.
Did you know what you wanted to do in those early days? Like, I mean, you could have gone into, I don't know, maybe journalism or directing, you know, like, I guess there's probably quite a few avenues if you're sort of working in media type organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the first things I wanted to do was be a sports journalist. So I wanted to do written press initially. And my dad, where one of the guys that used to drink within the pub, was a Daily Mail sports journalist. And he set me up with a call with him. And he essentially said, it's incredibly, incredibly competitive. Almost don't bother, you know, in a way. So he wasn't, you know, he was very encouraging and a really nice guy. But I got the impression that that might be an incredibly tough gig. So I started to think of where else I might be able to take it. And I ended up doing a media production degree at Northumbria Uni, which at the time I had friends at Leeds doing law and, you know, proper degrees. So, you know, when I, in 2000, when I went to uni, that was kind of a little bit say frowned upon, but it was a bit of a joke degree to a lot of people. But it that taught me so much. And when I did that degree, there was a film element where I was a producer. There was script writing. I had to write a feature-length script and learn off a scriptwriter who they brought in, and obviously the work experience and the job on Biker Grove, all these kinds of things. So I just started, my perspective and my ambition started to slightly shift, I think, from that point. So from uni onwards, I started to think, you know, maybe sort of TV and video was where I wanted to head rather than the written side of things. So that was definitely a turning point.
I guess that was maybe early-ish internet. I mean, not early internet, but, you know, sort of like internet stage one, the first 10 years or something of like proper internet, a loose description.
It was.
I mean, calling producer can mean a million different things, right? Like a producer could just be a name slapped onto a thing that's they've hardly done anything versus somebody that was intimately involved in every single part of creating whatever that piece of media is. So, I mean, how would you define a creative producer? Or is do they have a million definitions?
Yeah, I think, you know, in my role there, in my role that was at the BBC, for example, in my role at the BBC, we were given a producer title, but, you know, you mentioned there about, you know, in terms of directing, was that something that I wanted to do? You were wearing all of those hats. So you were producing, you were directing, you were script editing, so that was the beauty of, you know, the role at MTV and through into my career in BBC Sport, you were asked to do everything. I mean, a lot, you know, that's become more and more the case now, you know, as budgets get cut. But, you know, I think, you know, creative producer role, you know, that meant a lot of things, certainly at the BBC. So I did get the opportunity to direct, learn from directors. Again, another fantastic part of my learning at the BBC was I could learn from people who've been doing it 20 years. And I was incredibly fortunate to work with these very, very, very experienced producers who have been shooting on film and spending X amount on an incredible opener for the Six Nations or the Olympics, whatever it was. And I could learn how to direct, how to produce, how to write a script from uni and sort of build on that. So in that sort of being called a creative producer, was you weren't perhaps just doing the match of the day match edits, if you take the BBC Sport example. You know, there were people who were brilliant at that editorially, but I found myself more of the creative coming up with an idea. And, you know, you're often having to do it week on week on week. For example, Football Focus, when I worked on that, it's a sit that is it, you're interviewing a manager or you're interviewing a footballer. How can you continue to try and do it differently every single week? So you've got to skin a cat in a million different ways. So that was something that was a brilliant challenge. And again, just made you constantly think differently. Again, it was a really good challenge, and you're given the reins to do kind of what you want. It's so quick turnaround. There's kind of no one watching. And then you get to the point where people then trust you and they know they don't need to watch you so closely. It's been brilliant throughout my career that early doors, I was just chucked in, but I had great people to sort of just watch how they were doing it and put my own spin on it, really.
It sounds a little bit like sort of being a TV showrunner, you know, for a TV show where they'll have directors per episode, etc. But, you know, they'll be kind of overseeing the script and the general shape and feel and look and feel of whatever the thing is and which direction it's going in, you know. So it's kind of like you're overseeing sort of all of it, really, essentially.
Yeah, I think when I was sort of in the MTV and BBC Sport days, because you were pretty much a one-man band in those days. But by the time I've now got through to the position I'm in now, kind of in that showrunner role, you know, I'm able to have an understanding of how a budget runs, how a schedule will need to run on a shoot, what the director's treatment will need to look like, you know, all of those elements. I'm not like an absolute, you know, I don't want to say jack of all trades, master of none, but I've got an understanding of all of them, which gives me firstly, an appreciation of the amount of work they're doing and what they need to do to make the shoot a success. But it's also just having that full understanding of, as a team, bringing everyone together and what they need to hear to make it a success and try and go, you know, have we thought about this or we thought about that? And just try and not be too imposing, but just try and offer enough if needed, to kind of elevate everything and bring everything together and just oversee everything. So yeah, that's, as I sat here now, I feel like I've got this sort of like armory of skills and armory of incredible contacts that's able to make the business a success as it is in its own way.
So when you're doing your work now for clients, is it largely visual mediums that you're creating, et cetera? So sort of video content in a fashion? I mean, I guess over the last 20 years, obviously media has changed massively. So what might have just been video now is, I guess, sliced and diced across social in all sorts of ways. How has that sort of presented added challenges, I guess? I mean, you've only started the agency in the last 5 years, but I guess you've been working across different types of media, you know, in the last 20. So, I mean, has that created more challenges as you've gone on, or is it more fun to work out how to be creative with different, I don't know, aspect ratios and things? I don't know.
Yeah, it has definitely. When I began my career, the internet was in its infancy. Smartphones didn't exist. You know, not sound like a dinosaur, but you go back to, you know, 2003. It was a very different landscape, and it was all about TV, and that was the cachet. If you were on TV, you know, that was where you wanted to be. And people almost turned their nose up at socials or YouTube or anything like that. And I think that was probably still the case with, you know, because I started off in television, even making that transition through to branded content, things like that in 2014, there was still a little bit of a stigma attached to it, felt like, certainly from my peers at the time. But what it has given is a huge amount of other opportunity to create this other kind of content that is fast. It's like how I feel like I thrive is more in the sort of commercial world. I have, you know, produced and directed documentaries, and I do love a long form editorial story as long as I'm passionate about it. I struggle if I'm given a subject I'm not really that interested in and I have to make 60 or 90 minutes, for example. Whereas, you know, making a 30 second or a 60 second really exciting creative promo or commercial gets me going. So the social media world creating that content is almost, you know, tailor-made for me in that respect. So that was quite an exciting opportunity. Obviously, things are moving so, so quickly and things are changing, trends, you know, the way people are consuming, the amount of meetings that I've been in, even, you know, in certain companies where, you know, 1 year it's everyone wants 30-second content, the next year they want 4 minutes, the next year they want to, it's constantly kind of jumping around. But, you know, it's certainly been a challenge that I've relished. And what I've also looked to do is, you know, brought in people who live and breathe that culture and live and breathe that content, you know, content that is aimed for a 22-year-old male or female. As a 42-year-old man, perhaps I can't speak to that directly. And with some help from other people, bringing in people for the team, we can get to a really good place and I can, you know, oversee the general direction of it. But I think being aware enough to bring in other people and your opinion isn't always right, and having an open forum has been, again, has just brought us the best results. Speaking to clients about ideas as well, we'd rarely go into a meeting and go, there's your one idea. There you go. It's brilliant. We always try and go in with three, maybe four ideas, and we can bounce around and start conversation off and have a conversation about getting to the best place. So there's lots and lots of opportunity with social media. A kind of a negative in some ways, I guess, is everyone now is a video content creator. So there's so much video content out there. You've really got to find something to stand out. And the way we feel like we've done that is we have kept the business deliberately nimble and deliberately boutique to put more dollars on screen. You know, that's how we've always worked it. Because there's so much content out there, ours has to look a cut above. So we aren't an agency that has lots of cameras in a cupboard and we just kind of blow a whistle and everyone stands up and grabs a camera and we just run, you know, we get commercial DOPs in, directors, a proper team. You know, when you go on a set with us, if it's the founder side of the business, because we've split it, which I'll explain in a moment, but that has to feel and look high end because that work needs to stand out. We've then got our social side of the company, which is we've called Founder X, which is for that more nimble, quicker turnaround, smaller budget type stuff. So we've got those differences in the business. However, we still want to hit premium. So that's why we don't take on too many clients as well, because I still want to remain across all of the projects. So that is a key thing to our success, putting more dollars on screen, putting more dollars on screen, not having huge overheads at the back. We haven't got 50 people in a big swanky loft office. You know, we deliberately keep it nimble, and we can then make sure what we're putting out looks better, or we feel looks good, and we want to put our name to it, because that's the most important thing. And that is what we hope will make us stand out from the crowd and keep people coming back.
Yeah, you mentioned sort of changing requests or for formats and things from brands in the last few years and from clients. Are there any sort of typical ways that, you know, you sort of measure success with these brands in terms of, you know, delivering on the brief, et cetera? Has that changed? Has that become more sort of opaque and harder to measure, or given the rise of digital and all these different platforms?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's always so many sort of data and insights and data points for everything that we kind of, everything that we create, that there's, you know, there's certainly very clear metrics that you can you know, measure the success of a piece of content with. So, you know, we're always beholden to that. I think that, you know, if there's something that is shared and widely spoken about, for example, we did an Erling Haaland commercial when he was dropped into Clash of Clans. That was the work for Supercell with Axis Studios and the David Agency in New York. And that did incredibly well. The BBC picked it up. Lots of sort of national news agencies picked it up. It really blew up on YouTube, like 60 million views, I think, and 150 million overall. So there was lots and lots of data points there where you can go, that was a big success. So I think in terms of being able to cut through and achieve that success isn't easy. But when you've got an elite athlete and an idea and everything else that comes together, you've got the ingredients there for hopefully something that could be, you know, really a real success. So we've been fortunate enough to be involved in a few of those. The McLaren Formula One project, where they gave an artist the car to design in Japan this year. We've done that a couple of times with views for their Driven by Change campaign. And again, the measure there, that had been, again, a huge success for them. So there's all of that kind of measurements. I think there's also a time where we make a brilliant piece of work, or we deem it to be fantastic, and it might not have that level of performance for one reason or another. It might not have had paid media behind it, or it might have been pushed in the schedule and got drowned out by something else. So, you know, you can still make great work and it be a success for a brand, I think, even if it doesn't hit wild numbers. You know, we've often had clients come back and say, that was the best piece of work that we've produced. And for them, that has been a success. And as a brand piece, it's been a great piece for them. So I think there's other ways it can be measured away from the sort of graphs. And yeah, as I say, we've been fortunate enough to be involved in a couple of those, and clients have still been happy with the work we've produced.
Yeah, if it fits into their strategy, I guess. So yeah,
exactly.
It's like kind of complements whatever they're doing, et cetera.
Yeah,
I was going to ask about your role at EA, Electronic Arts. I assume, has that sort of then transferred into what you're doing now in terms of, I don't know, more gaming? Are you finding generally you're speaking to more gaming clients and producing stuff, more stuff in sort of, not necessarily the metaverse, but you know, gaming worlds and platforms?
Yeah, EA was a brilliant experience, and one I'm so glad that I was given the opportunity to do. And obviously, you know, it's a big move for me and, you know, my wife to move over there, things like that. So it was a huge, huge commitment to move over to Vancouver and live out there and take on a completely new role, because the role was a brand new role at that time. It was created and I was the first person to step into that. They had actually kind of struggled to fill that role, it turns out. And I think they've been on the hunt for sort of 6 months or so. And that, I believe they were looking at more sort of a gaming person. And obviously I was more of a football person and a creative out of that. And it was kind of, the decision was made to bring me in, having, you know, lots and lots of rounds of interviews, but bring me in and then I could learn the gaming side of it, if you like, and the what you can and can't do. But I had the football knowledge. So that was exciting to go in, I think, with maybe a fresh perspective. You know, I had a lot to learn, and it was a, you know, big tech company. So it was built to work in that way. And the marketing arm was there, but it was still kind of growing. So it was a very exciting position to take. So I was leading the creative for the marketing for FIFA. So EA Sports, FIFA as it was, EA FC now. And yeah, it was a brilliant opportunity. I think there was so much scope to do work that was going to be seen by lots and lots of people. It felt like a very exciting place to be. And Ronaldo had just gone on the cover when I joined, and all these kinds of things. So it was, yeah, it was a fantastic place to work. And yeah, you just got the opportunity to, you know, it was a bit of a dream, really, you know, a bit like when I started at Television Centre with BBC Sport. Was a bit like sort of Willy Wonka's chocolate factory you walk into, and it feels like an incredible place. It's a little bit like that with EA, walking in there. And, you know, I'd played FIFA, I'd played Madden, I'd played, you know, NHL, all the games. And I was then sat in the office with all the people who marketed that, and in the, you know, up the hallway was where it was made. So a fantastic experience, and, you know, one I'm really grateful for. Is, you know, $2 billion franchise. So it was quite a bit of pressure to, you know, each year reinvent, you know, or each year keep people interested, really. You know, the game, you know, it's not like other titles, like Call of Duty or whatever it is. We come out every single year. So really challenging, but fantastic. And again, people there, Dave Jackson, Paul Maher, you know, Andy Galluli, Anthony Doyle, all these guys that I worked with, who backed me as well, because you're working then with brand, you're working with campaign, you're working with strategy. Rather than, you know, the BBC days, for example, I then had a lot of stakeholders, and it all had to be absolutely aligned to one key vision, you know, and it had to do all these other jobs. So a real learning experience, I think, in terms of being part of that tech company and how that worked. But I came out of it a much better operator, I'd say. And then in terms of how Founder developed from that, having that experience from gaming and what can be done and can't be done, I think has definitely stood us in great stead, understanding, you know, what, you know, other gaming companies coming to us and working with those. So that's been a fantastic sort of thing that we've been able to bring to the business as well.
And I suppose before that, you were, I guess, largely creating sort of live action with people, etc. For EA, was it a lot more sort of essentially computer generated based on, you know, characters from games, etc., that you're then creating in a sort of cutscenes and things like that?
Yeah, there was a bit of a mix, actually. When I first arrived, my boss at the time, there was a lots and lots of, other than the TV commercial, everything out, there was a lot of gameplay promos. So it was a lot of in-game capture. And I was really keen to try and bring in more live action and, you know, go out and do a lot more shoots. And there was a few other people within the business who felt the same, and, you know, we could get out. And actually, it was immersing ourselves in football culture. You know, we were kind of making the argument that everyone knows what the game looks like. It doesn't move on that much each year, but what we can do is really lean into football culture and go and shoot with your Ronaldos and, you know, whoever it might be, and get those big people, those incredible athletes involved in directly in the video content. So that was a great opportunity. So I felt like perhaps I could bring a little bit of that to the party, and people got behind that, which was great. What was really interesting was obviously then when you did need to incorporate the gameplay, working with the sort of Frostbite team and people like that. And you'd be working, you know, one of the greatest moments of my career was we came up with, like, why don't we get Hans Zimmer and we'll remix the Champions League theme? So it was just preposterous thought. However, EA had the resources to do it, you know. So, you know, I remember being at Air Studios in Hampstead with Hans Zimmer, you know, with gameplay up on the screen and the horn section from, like, The Dark Knight playing to this game, this action on the screen that, you know, I'd been part of coordinating, like, oh, so there'll be a step over here and we need his shoulder to go out of shot here and the camera will whip here. And so you could talk as well, you could direct the game capture team and the Frostbite team who made the cinematics in a bespoke way to show exactly what you wanted to. So you can't have a camera running next to Ronaldo on a football pitch, but in this world you could. So you could have incredibly exciting angles And again, that was something like, everyone knows the angles that you see on telly. We can put the camera wherever we want. So let's do it. That, you know, directors would dream of putting a camera on Ronaldo's face as he's running towards the goal, you know? So we lent into that a lot more as well. And I think, you know, the team got a lot more, not just through me, but, you know, everyone got, you know, it was really starting to move on at that point with the technology as well, with Frostbite and the engine that we were using. So yeah, that was all a very exciting time, but bringing together gameplay, live action, the soundtrack, all of those things. FIFA's known for its soundtrack, you know, so that was another huge part of the experience. So yeah, a very exciting time. And as I say, I learned a lot from that.
Yeah, sort of blending of virtual and physical worlds, use of, I guess, celebrity slash influencer, if you're using, you know, football stars, etc. It kind of brings it to life and probably evokes a lot more emotion in people than, say, watching pure gameplay.
Exactly. I think that was exactly it. You've hit the nail on the head there. And that was one of the reasons why we wanted to kind of do that. You know, if this is going on Ronaldo's channel, we'd love to try and, you know, feature him in it, you know, if we can, or, you know, if it is going to be gameplay, let's try and make it with the cinematic team. So it looks, you know, absolutely fantastic. And, you know, so mixing those two worlds, which was again, something we did with Haaland in the Clash of Clans Supercell spot just earlier this year, mixing real world and gameplay has proven to be really successful. And yeah, that was a really exciting time, and being able to put your director hat on and be able to put the camera where you wanted on a pitch and, you know, these dream angles was, again, a brilliant experience.
We've got to wrap up in like 5 minutes or so. So I'll try and rattle through a few questions, but a couple of things I wanted to touch on. One thing, obviously you mentioned Hans Zimmer. The theme at the magazine for December is around sort of sound and music and the kind of use of that in a sort of creative commercial sense. And how much have you touched on use of sound in what you do? Obviously, the Hans Zimmer one is a great example because you're working literally right next to a composer composing shots. So I think it was Spielberg that said if he wasn't a director, he would have wanted to be a composer, which was interesting.
Yeah, I think music is absolutely key to the success of a film. You know, I know that, you know, now there's obviously, you know, we're often charged with this has to work on mute, you know, because on socials, people won't be listening to it. Then we've had data back that everyone's now listening to it and you really need to pay attention to it. But, you know, there's obviously been times where it has to be engaging enough to not have any audio, which again, visually brings more of a, you know, pressure to that, and it can't be completely reliant on a script, for example, or will people read the subtitles, things like that. So, but where I have had the opportunity, music, it has been such a huge thing. I remember someone at the BBC, there was a director there called Richard Gort, and he told me one time, he was like, you know, music is 50% of the film that you're making. And I kind of have always taken that with me and how crucial it is. Unfortunately, there are often times where you don't have 50K to use a commercial track, you know, and you do end up with a grand and you pull out a production library track. And, you know, there are some gems in there, but, you know, that when you do get the opportunity to use a brilliant piece of music, you know, having that opportunity to work with Hans Zimmer was mind blowing. And, you know, that was one of, if not the greatest moment, I think, for me. But yeah, I think it's hugely important, I think. And lots of the ads that resonate with me, I remember the music, like the Surfer, the Guinness ad, you know, things like that. There's certain ones, and like the Nike ads with, you know, a little less conversation, and just the music that has gone with it it sticks in my mind almost as much as the visuals, you know? So I think that it plays such a key role, and it shouldn't be a secondary thought. It's almost like get the music right and then almost like the rest will follow. It paces your film. It's the emotion of what you're creating. It's, you know, the vocals, all those kinds of things. It's a crucial part of it. So yeah, absolutely important.
Good stuff. Yeah, like I said, we've got to wrap up soon. So I'll just, I don't know if this counts as quick fire exactly, but
I'll try and be quick.
Well, I'll go with sort of one last normal question, then we'll do a tiny quick fire.
Okay.
So you mentioned sort of luxury at one point. I don't know, some of obviously the clients you're working with definitely count in the luxury category. Do you, as well as the sort of pushing into gaming, are you sort of moving more towards luxury clients in terms of the content you produce, or is that just a sort of a natural evolution of where the business is, or?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we love motorsport here. Motorsport, you know, Formula One, and, you know, there's often luxury brands associated with certain sports. You know, you're seeing more and more brands now seeing the value in sports and sporting events. So them leveraging those events and leveraging athletes and things like that, we're inevitably working more and more with those kinds of brands. You know, there might be a watch deal with an elite athlete, or there might be a car deal, or, you know, whatever it might be. So, you know, working, obviously, those kind of aspirational brands have got budget and do want to kind of muscle in on the, you know, on what sport can offer. So, you know, we specialize in sport and gaming, really, but, you know, we are absolutely working with looking to work with other brands as well. And, you know, there's brands in Dubai and places like that that we're sort of talking to, and, you know, trading platforms and things like that as well. So there's lots and lots of brands out there that are leaning more into sports, whether it's athletes or clubs or federations. So it's inevitably the way that I think things are going to go. So yeah, and it also just offers variety. I think it's great to launch a new football boot or a new bit of kit, but it's also great to think about something completely different. So it presents a nice challenge for us when those opportunities do come up.
Yeah, it definitely feels like there's a few Venn diagrams of, I don't know, sport, entertainment, gaming, luxury, and they're all kind of melded together a little bit these days. So I feel like a lot more luxury brands are sort of playing in the digital world, they're playing in the sport world.
For sure. Well. Yeah, we're seeing a lot of that, especially with major events coming up. And it'll be interesting to see sort of the World Cup in North America, you know, and sort of what goes on there and how that moves on. So yeah, lots of interesting events in the pipeline.
Good stuff. Well, my final quick fire questions. You worked on Top of the Pops, I believe.
Yes.
Briefly, for a little bit. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but that was around the time when Top of the Pops ended after 42 years. What did you do? What happened?
Yeah, I've worked on I've sank a couple of shows. I didn't sink Top Gear or Top of the Pops.
Top Gear was my next question. So.
Yeah, right. So, well, with Top of the Pops, that was... that was my, you know, after MTV, that was my first, like, it was going back into music, which was obviously a big passion of mine. And that was, it was starting to, by that point, it was bouncing around the schedule a little bit. You know, at that point, I was working, I think the show was going out on a Sunday, I think, and was, you know, would sometimes skip a week. It was at the time when sort of downloads were starting to first start up, and, you know, Napster and things like this were all starting to come in. So it was affecting the charts, and, you know, it was, you know, the format was how it was, and being on TV was becoming less and less important by sort of 05, 06. So there was a big sort of shift in that, and it did feel like it was sort of, it was tailing off. It was still like, for me to be able to say I worked on that show, you know, my mum and dad sort of met dancing in like the Ritz in Manchester to that, you know, so it's got, you know, Top of the Pops has got a special place in my heart, and obviously an iconic show. But that was walking into TV Centre, what a place that was, you know. It was, yeah, that was proper sort of Willy Wonka stuff, with Jules Holland was on and Match of the Day and all the rest of it. And it was a brilliant show to work. And I was making the insert reel with an editor, which was anything that wasn't live, you'd then have a tape to go to. So the Strokes would come in and record three songs. You'd put them out over the next few weeks. Stevie Wonder would be doing it, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I was making that tape. I was only there for about 6 or 8 months, because actually at the Christmas, it was Sports Personality of the Year being recorded. And me and a few of the guys, we snuck in around the back through sort of the props department and went into the main party for Sports Personality, where everyone was having a drink. You were surrounded by all the great and good of, you know, the sporting world. And I remember thinking, I'd like to be part of this at some point. And that was kind of when I started moving into sport. But yeah, it was an incredible time, brilliant time, really pleased I was part of it. And yeah, I did leave before the final episode. I was out the door probably 4 or 5 months before that happened.
Oh, fair enough. Well, I don't know. I always said, you know, you're getting old when you recognize more shows on Top of the Pops 2 than Top of the Pops 1. That was the thing.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm more Radio 2 than Radio 1 these days. Six okay. Music. Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's allowed. and then I guess final thing, I guess you were on Top Gear for a little bit. What was that like? I imagine a lot of the guys that worked on, people that worked on that sort of moved over to the Grand Tour for a few years afterwards.
They did. You know, some friends of mine who were editors on Top Gear before the big move. They moved onto the Grand Tour, a few of them. And yeah, there had been a bit of a shift. So when I began, there was quite a new team being brought in. There was a few old faces, but generally quite a lot of new blood. And, you know, I wanted to take that job. You know, I wanted to work with Chris Evans. You know, when I was growing up, like, he was, you know, the god of television, you know, with TFI and Don't Forget Your Toothbrush and, you know, Big Breakfast and everything else. So it was, again, an incredible experience. You've got the responsibility of such a huge show. And it was a fantastic experience. We got to do some brilliant stuff, you know, big budgets, traveling the world, again, coming up with ideas. I was leading a bit of a team there. You know, we split into sort of three teams, so sort of overseeing that. Again, fantastic to be part of that and have that sort of brand on my CV, if you like. Obviously, you know, it's not around so much nowadays, but it was great to have been part of that sort of next phase of it, I guess.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like over the last sort of 20 years or spanning your career in general, that you've touched on some really interesting shifts and changes in media and the sort of platforms that we all take for granted now, perhaps. Sort of seen things come and go, maybe. I guess I keep reflecting. I don't know. I'm just in a reflective mood today. But yeah, I don't know. It's just an interesting time. We'll have to get you to write some stuff for the magazine, maybe, or about, you know, these types of platforms and the challenges that, you know, around them, if you want to, of course.
Yeah, I would love that. I mean, you know, I speak to people now. I remember speaking to some guys in like their 20s, and I said, oh yeah, I used to work at MTV. And they were like, what's MTV?
Yeah. Of course.
So that was tough. That was a tough conversation. So
what's Tumblr? That's always, I always like that. I'm like, I miss Tumblr. I miss old Tumblr.
Exactly. All that kind of stuff. So, you know, MySpace and everything else. So we've definitely been, I feel very fortunate actually to have been part of the generation that, you know, just pre-internet really kicking off, and having kind of, yeah, lived through that and been part of a few shows. So that, it's been great. And it's, I've been very fortunate, I think, in that respect. So yeah, it makes me feel old, but I'm happy for it.
it's good, I think. Yeah, reflecting on things you've done and lots of things ahead, by the sounds of it, as well. So
I hope so. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, we're fortunate. We're busy and it's going well. And hopefully we can keep going from strength to strength and keep making some fun stuff.
Good stuff. Well, I could quiz you on your career all day, but we need to end there. So just want to say thanks so much, Tom, for coming on the Media Cat Magazine podcast.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.